Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
Hello and welcome to Antiquitas. Brett McKay is founder and editor-in-chief of The Art of Manliness, the largest independent men's lifestyle magazine on the web, with over 10 million monthly page views. The Art of Manliness also includes a podcast with over 100 million total downloads. In addition to having a law degree, Brett McKay is a humanist, and he focused on classics as an undergraduate. His career, I think, offers a terrific answer to the question that many of our students ask, what can you do with a humanities degree? Well, Brett's done a lot with it. He's the author of several books, and I'm particularly interested in one of them, The Spartan Way, What Modern Men Can Learn from Ancient Warriors. It's an ebook available on Amazon.com, and it is short, but it's packed with valuable information. Brett, thank you for taking the time to join us on Antiquitas today.
Barry, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. I'm really interested in talking to you because Sparta is very much on our minds this year. Our focus this season is on great battles of Greece and Rome. Last week, our listeners heard a podcast about the Battle of Thermopylae. I'd like to revisit Thermopylae today with a focus on the bigger issues, on what you call what modern men can learn from ancient warriors. Now, to those who weren't with us in the last episode, Thermopylae was a battle that took place in August of 480 BC. It took place when the Persian Empire was invading Greece. Thermopylae is located in central Greece, and there a Greek army tried to stop the Persian invaders at a narrow pass. There were about 7,000 Greeks spearheaded by 300 Spartans, and they faced an enemy that outnumbered them by something like 20 to 1, maybe 150,000 Persians. They were able to do this crazy-sounding thing because Thermopylae is a very narrow pass. Actually, I should say it was a very narrow pass because the topography has changed since antiquity. And in several days of very hard fighting, they gave the Persians a savage beating. The Persians ultimately won, but at a terrible cost. The Greeks had 4,000 deaths. The Persians had 20,000. These are approximations. And the Greek deaths most famously included 300 Spartans, including their king. And that's why Thermopylae is such a legendary battle as a last stand. Now, Brett, you describe Sparta in your book, The Spartan Way, as, and I'm quoting, a tiny warrior community that managed to command the respect of its neighbors and leave a legend for all time. And that undoubtedly has much to teach about the nature of longings within modern bourgeois society and how they might be fulfilled, at least slightly, in the present age. You write about three kinds of lessons in particular, which I'll call constant testing, mutual dependence, and being a battle-ready warrior. So today I'd like to talk mainly about the third subject, being a battle-ready warrior, because that suits the context of Thermopylae. But if we might, let's start with the first two. How did constant testing and mutual dependence manifest themselves in Sparta? And what relevance does that have for today's men?
Yeah, so I think to understand Sparta, you have to understand their whole culture was geared towards warfare. Everything about it was directed towards that, and if it didn't contribute to warfare, they probably didn't do it. So the constant testing, it began when a Spartan was born. Instead of being bathed in water, a Spartan baby, both the boys and the girls, were bathed in wine to see how they'd react to it. And if they could withstand it and it looked like they were responding well to the wine, well, then the baby was kept. But if it wasn't, then the baby was left exposed or maybe given away as a slave. So yeah, the Spartans practiced infanticide. So that testing began right when you were born, and this was a state decision. This wasn't something the parents decided. This was something the regime decided. Moving on with the boys, for the first 6 years of their life, they had a pretty normal childhood. They're with their mothers. But then at age 7, they were taken apart from their mothers, and they were put with boys their same age, had their heads shaved, given a simple cloak for clothing, given a scythe. That was the only weapon they could have. That was the tool of the helot, so sort of indicate they were servile. And their education began to become a Spartan. And this education involved, of course, physical training, gymnastics, but it also involved, they learned how to read, they learned how to write, they learned poetry, philosophy, rhetoric, logic. And throughout this time, there was testing as well to see if they were learning the things of a Spartan gentleman. When they became an adolescent, they were able to grow their hair out a bit, and the physical education continued. They learned how to be a gentleman, so they learned etiquette, things like, you know, you walked with your hands inside your robe. You learn not to stare at other people. You don't walk and talk at the same time. And then during when they were an adolescent, they were brought before the older men, the Spartans, and they were tested sort of catechism style about Spartan values, about philosophy. So there, again, you see this testing going on. And then around age 18, age 20, their training continued. They actually started wearing, you know, armor. They started taking part in mock battles. And then they had their capstone of this education, which was the agoge, which was the cryptia. And they were basically sent out into the polis. They had to seclude themselves. Yeah, cryptia, you know, kind of means secret. It means secret in Greek. And they were just forced to live by themselves. And it was basically, you could call it special forces, you know, bushcraft survival training. And a part of that, according to some accounts, was you had to kill a helot and not be detected. And if you completed this task, this test, then you were considered an equal, a peer. You were officially a Spartan. So you, as you can see, yeah, there's this testing that happened all throughout their lives. And then even the testing continued, and we'll talk about this here in a bit. Actually, nice segues nicely to the next part of your question, which was that mutual dependence. So after a Spartan boy or Spartan young man completed the agoge successfully, he was considered a peer. He had to apply to join Syssitia. I think that's how you pronounce it. My Greek isn't very good. I focused on the Latin.
You got it right. Yeah. No, it's good.
Yeah. The Syssitia, it was basically a dining club. It was a fraternity. And this was your unit. There was about 15 men in a dining club, and you had to apply for it. And usually they were sort of grouped by, personality types, family lineage, political leanings. Like, it was basically common. Like, you had something in common with them. You had to apply. The members voted. If it had to be unanimous, if you got blackballed, there was one, you know, dissenting vote, you were blackballed, couldn't join. But once you were a member, you were a member for life. And the Syssitia, the whole point of that was to foster this camaraderie with your fellow soldiers. And then within the Syssitia, there were part of that building up the camaraderie. There were these sort of like, I would call them duels, right? Verbal duels where you would kind of tease each other and make fun of each other and rib each other. And this is where the whole famous laconic wit comes into play, where the whole point was to come up with these like great stinging barbs that you could say in the fewest amount of words. And we look at that and we think, oh, teasing's bad. But no, like, teasing is a way to develop camaraderie, right? Because it shows that you can take it and you can give it. So again, there's that testing element going on there, and it's all geared towards building up that camaraderie. And the reason why mutual dependence and why the Spartans place such an emphasis on unity of the group, and there's another thing to point out, but for the mutual dependence, Spartan men, they didn't live with their families. They didn't live with their wives. They had to sleep with their unit in the barracks, and they ate with the unit in the barracks. And the reason why they did that was because the way they fought. They fought in the phalanx. And to understand the phalanx, you have to understand the weaponry of a Spartan hoplite, particularly the shield. Their shield weighed about 15 pounds. It was a circle, 3 feet in diameter, and they held it in their left arm. Now, what this does, it protects the left side of their body, but it keeps the right side of their body exposed. So if they were out there on their own, they could be easy pickings, right, to an enemy. But if you had a fellow soldier on your right side who was holding his shield in his left side, it would cover the right side of your body, and you would be protected. And so this mutual dependence, like, your safety depended on whether the guy next to you was going to hold his place in the phalanx line. And then the flip is true. Like the safety of your fellow soldier depended on you holding the line as well. Everyone's safety depended on everyone else doing their job. And so there was definitely shame. Shame was a huge motivating factor in Spartan culture. They were an honor culture. There was a great fear of letting their fellow men down because it would bring disgrace to them and to their family. So there is that element, but there's also, I think, just a love for your fellow soldier, your fellow brother at arms. You wanted to take care of them. You wanted to protect them. And that started with, you know, you grew up with these guys in the agoge, and then you ate with them, you slept with them, you dined with them, you made fun of each other. And so that played out in war. You guys took care of each other by standing in line because you loved your fellow brother at arms. And you even see this today in military, when you ask combat soldiers particularly, like, why do you fight? Like, are you fighting for ideals, America? And they'll say, yeah, but like what they'll say is, no, really, when it comes down to it, I'm fighting for the guy next to me. I want to make sure he gets home safely. It's that love of comrade that helped the Spartans, you know, be so successful what they did.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Do you think this could be relevant to our society more generally today in non-military contexts?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly with men, men want to test. They want to know. I write about my site's The Art of Manly. We talk about masculinity.
Right.
Manhood is something you earn, right? Like men know, like you're either a male, but to become a man, you have to do something. And I feel like men, particularly young men, in their teenage years, young adulthood, they want something they can say, I did something and my peers recognize me as a man. And we don't really have too many things like that in modern culture anymore. They're sort of there, but they've been sort of watered down and we don't really put much too emphasis on that. And then also, I think men want to belong to something, want to belong to a group. And you see a lot of men are just isolated. They don't have any friends. They don't have any family. They're detached from family, from community, but they crave something. And that's why, I mean, some sociologists would say that's why you see a lot of young men join gangs, right? Because they don't have that positive group that they could belong to, but they want to feel like they belong to something. So yeah, I think there is something that's applicable today that we can provide. Maybe not like definitely not like the Spartans, which is very totalitarian, right?
Right.
But I think there is a yearning in all of us for, a test to see that, do I have the right stuff? Can I prove myself? Can I push myself beyond what I'm able, capable of thinking I can do? And can I belong to a group who's going to encourage me to be the best that I can be? I think men want that.
Okay. I think so too. Just to ask a follow-up question. What if these groups were gender neutral? What if they were co-ed? What if they were male and female? Would that make a difference?
I don't know. I think it's possible, but I think it's important. I think there's differences between men and women in the way they interact with each other. And that's okay. I'm not saying that one is better than the other, but I think there's a place in our culture where you can have male groups where you get together and you do that thing with men, but then you also have female groups. Then I think it's also possible to come together and have the same sort of thing. I think it's a little trickier because I think there are differences in expectations of how you're supposed to interact with one another. But I think it's possible. It's not impossible, but I think it's trickier. And it takes a little more thought and a bit more intention for it to happen.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. So let's segue a bit into Thermopylae. And I want to begin by asking, why does Thermopylae have such a hold on our imagination today? We have novels about Thermopylae, history books about Thermopylae. A few years ago, there was a very successful movie about Thermopylae, 300. Assuming that we don't identify with the Persians who won the battle, why are we so interested in a great defeat? And Thermopylae was a defeat. Especially as Americans, don't we usually identify with the winners? George Patton said to the Third Army in World War II, General George Patton, quote, "Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser." If that's so, why do we love Thermopylae?
Well, I think we also love a good underdog story as Americans. I think we even see that in our own history. The Alamo is a great example where it was a defeat, but we think of like, oh, remember the Alamo? That was, Americans fighting, even though everything that the chips were against and they still fought. You also see it like, I think the Battle of the Chosen Reservoir during the Korean War, it was a defeat because the Americans had to retreat, but those guys did something that was incredible. It was one of the largest retreats in military history, and the coordination that was required to make that happen was phenomenal. And the heroism and the courage and the bravery that these guys had to undergo when they were just surrounded by hundreds of thousands of Chinese in the bitter cold, they became legends, right? Even though there was a defeat. So I think we do love an underdog story. And I also think you can lose, but as long as you lose the right way, right? There's a sense of honor in that. Like this is a very British Anglo idea, right?
Right.
It reminds me, I thought of the Charge of the Light Brigade, right? This is when the British were facing the Russians and it was a defeat. They didn't really do anything. Nothing happened from it. They lost a lot of lives, but it became this legend because the British soldiers, like they played the game right. They fought with honor. And as long as you fight with honor and you still lose, that's okay because you still have your honor. So yeah, I think there's part of it that we like an underdog story, but we also respect the idea of soldiers who play the game right and fight with honor.
That's really interesting. I mean, maybe in a way, defeat is a better test than victory because, you know, we say about victory, you know, whatever it takes to win, do whatever it takes. You don't have to win. You can win dirty and it's still a victory. But if you play the game the way it's supposed to be played, even at the cost of losing, well, that shows that you really believe in the ideals. So maybe that's one reason why we love Thermopylae.
That could be it. I think there's something to that.
Yeah. Well, thanks. So let's go through some of the battle and I think hit on some of the points you talk about in your book. So you talk, and we'll talk about being a battle-ready warrior. You talk about the importance of appearance and ritual in the Spartan way of war. And as you know, you also talk about in your book, there's a famous detail that before the battle, the Persians sent spies to see what the Spartans were doing, and they saw that the Spartans were combing their hair. And the spies came back, reported that to Xerxes. He was very confused by this and had to ask a Spartan defector what it meant. So what did it mean? What do you make of it? And how would you respond to someone who said it was a little foppish, even ridiculous?
Yeah. So there's this idea, particularly in modern society, that men don't care about the way they look. But it's not true. I mean, if you look across cultures, men care greatly about how they look, and particularly in warfare, because they want to look fierce to scare the enemy. Right. They also do it for themselves. So there's this idea of enclothed cognition, right? The clothes you wear can change the way you feel about yourself and the way you think. And they've done studies where, like, you know, they put lab coats on people and people suddenly feel smarter, right? just by putting a lab coat. Or you could put a lab coat on someone and if you're observing the person in the lab coat, there's this thing, the halo effect. You're like, oh, that person must be really smart even though they're just an actor, right? Like you see this with like pharmaceutical commercials on TV, right? There's some an attractive person in a lab coat. Doctors say, and like the person's probably not a doctor, but like we take the commercial a little bit more seriously because the person's in a white lab coat because we have this idea of, you know, what the white lab coat means. So I think we underplay the idea of enclothed cognition to our detriment if we say, oh, it just doesn't matter. Well, it does matter. It can matter. It can make a difference. And so the Spartans who took a great care in their appearance, probably they did it for themselves. It probably made them feel stronger, fiercer, braver. But it also was to scare the enemy. I mean, most, if you think about most of innovations, or you think about most of male clothing that we wear today, most of it came from military uniforms. The suit.
Is that true?
That was basically a military uniform. And the way the suit is designed, the shoulders are broader and then it goes down to a taper. So it makes you look more masculine, right? You have the broad shoulders and the narrow waist supposed to give you that appearance. Even if you don't have that, it's gonna simulate that. The clothes we wear, like t-shirt, that came from the military. Jeans was a workwear. The khaki, military. I mean, you can go on and on. So I think, yeah, you might think it's silly, but no, it can mean a lot. Like, here's an example. Like, I'm doing this podcast recording for my house. I could have just stayed in my pajamas if I wanted to. But what I did, I put on a button down because I know it would change the way I would approach it. It makes me feel a little more professional. So what's the takeaway from that, right? We're not going to be Spartan warriors at the gates of fire, right? But if you're going in for a big presentation, like spend some more time on the way you appear. You don't have to be fastidious about it, but care about it because it'll make you feel more confident and it can make other people take you more seriously as well.
That's really interesting. Thanks. I didn't know that about the military source of our clothes. So, you next talk about the importance of reverence for Spartan warriors. And one example of this is an inscription that was put up after the battle for a man named Megistius, who was a Spartan seer. The inscription says, "Here fought and fell Megistius, hero brave, slain by the Medes who crossed Spercheius's wave. Well knew the seer his doom, but scorned to fly, and rather chose with Sparta's king to die." So Megistius could see what was going to happen, and he had the chance to leave, but he chose instead to stay and fight. So thoughts about that?
No, so this is something that a lot of people don't know about the Spartans. They were very religious. They were very pious. In fact, they would often delay battles for religious ceremonies. The Athenians asked for the Spartans, and the Spartans like, no, sorry, we can't. We're, you know, doing our religious festivities this week. And though I think at Thermopylae...
it was Marathon.
Yeah, right. And I think in Thermopylae, the reason why there were only 300, there was some religious ceremonies going on that some of the other Spartans had to take part in. So they took their religion very seriously. And someone could look at that and say, well, that's just superstitious. Another way you can look at it is a sense of reverence. And reverence can be seen as humility. This idea that, yes, you can do all you can to train and prepare for battle, but in the end, you don't have ultimate control over the outcomes. And I think the Spartans respected that. And I think that's something that we lack in our culture, a humility, like a reverence. And by reverence, I mean a humility towards, I don't know if you want to call it fate or larger things bigger than ourselves. But I think having that humility can help you put things in perspective. It can help you avoid hubris, sort of this unadulterated pride or ego that causes you to take actions that were, you know, step out of the bounds that will actually lead to greater risk and danger and outcome. So I think that was an important part in to understand the way they behaved. They took the religion very seriously, which I think gave them a sense of humility that helped them, you know, become the fierce warriors that they were. Because they didn't take risks that were unnecessary, or they thought that were not necessarily not unnecessary, but they didn't step outside of their bounds. They knew their limits and they played within those limits.
Right. That's really interesting. How do you balance, to be a great warrior, don't you have to be arrogant in a certain sense? And how do you balance that with humility?
No, it's definitely a tension. I think it's possible. So, I mean, I think the phalanx is a great example of that balance, right? So, yes, it was up to you, right, to be fierce and be courageous and brave to hold the line, but your success depended on other people as well, right? So there was a certain humility in that way too. So yes, they encouraged you to be brave, but you also had to be humble, right? It wasn't all about you. So I think it is possible. It's definitely a tension. It's hard to do. It's hard to walk, but it certainly is possible. And I think the Spartans got it right for the most part.
Yeah, really interesting. So if the Spartans got it right, in some ways, the ultimate Spartan is their king at Thermopylae. Leonidas, of course, chooses to stay and die. And the question's asked, was he a hero or was he a failure? Did he do the right thing to make this decision to stay and fight, or should he have tried to escape? What do you make of Leonidas?
That's a really interesting question. I think it goes back to that idea that we were talking about earlier about fighting to win, or there's fighting with honor. And this is a tension that we've had in the West going all the way back to, I think it goes to the Iliad and the Odyssey. So there's these two characters that I think epitomize these two different ideas of victory, honor or just win at all cost. The honor idea is sort of embodied in Achilles. Your honor is the most important thing. You're even willing to risk the lives of all the other, your comrades, to defend your honor, right? And he went out in single combat at Troy to win. So it's all about him. And like you fought the guy head on, right? That was the honorable, manly way to fight. And then you have Odysseus, who had a sense of honor, but he was a trickster. He was willing to play tricks to win. So, you know, the famous Trojan horse. Well, that was Odysseus's idea, right? When he escaped the cave of the Cyclops. Well, he played a trick on the guy. It wasn't direct on fighting. He had to like blind the guy say that he was nobody, and then hide underneath the sheet.
Right.
But he won. And I mean, in Greek culture, Odysseus was both admired and kind of looked down upon at the same time. The Greeks admired his cleverness, but they looked down on his unmanly way of fighting, right, of victory, because it wasn't direct, head-on, the honorable way, mano to mano. And you see this tension between winning by trick or winning by honor play out even in in recent times. Look at the American Revolution. You saw this play out. George Washington, the first part of his career as a general of the Revolutionary Forces, he was a failure. He lost most of his battles. He was getting his butt kicked. And it was because he was fighting in this traditional European way where you line up your soldiers against the other side and you just shoot at each other. So it was the honorable way to fight, right? But at a certain point, Washington realized, well, we're going to get our butt kicked if we keep fighting like this, because the British have better arms, better trained soldiers, more soldiers, whatever. And so he decided at some point in the Revolutionary War to switch to a defensive, a war of attrition. And he started implementing guerrilla warfare as well. And that started turning the tide. But it was an unmanly way to, it was an ungentlemanly way to fight. And so, going back to Leonidas, it depends on how you frame victory. He lost, but he had honor, right? He was able to hold his head up high. He fought the manly way. And that was important for the Spartans. And so, I don't know. I mean, was he a failure? We could say, because he lost, right? What's more, he didn't actually win the battle. But he did win, in a way, for the Spartans. He held to their ideals. So I think we still have that. We're playing with that idea, too, with warfare today, because it's changing. We're moving away from the great state warfares of the 20th century, where there were rules and laws and guidelines and sort of an etiquette, to where they're calling it fourth generational warfare. It's guerrilla warfare type style. There's no rules and everything's sort of fast moving and improvised. So it's moving from an Achilles type warfare more to an Odysseus type warfare, where you win through tricks and redirections. And that's the way it is. So victory is the only thing that matters. Actually winning matters. So it's interesting that these ideas that we're playing with today or working with today, it goes back 2,000 years in Western culture.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, there's just Greek history, ancient history is full of lessons for today. Thank you for that. So following up on that, I want to just give you three anecdotes about the battle that I think follow in the same question about honor versus success. And they all come from Herodotus, the historian, our most important source for the battle. Herodotus was just a 5-year-old kid at the time of the battle, but he spoke to people who had been in the war between the Greeks and the Persians. He tells us that after King Leonidas fell fighting, that there was a huge pushing and shoving over his body between the Greeks and the Persians, and the Spartans, fighting hard, dragged the body away 4 times and put the enemy to flight. But then the Persians come back. They're led by a Greek trader through the hills around Thermopylae, and they're able to cut off the pass in the rear, cut off the Greek retreat. And then the other Greeks make a last stand on a low hill in the mouth of the pass. And Herodotus says, they defended themselves there with their swords, as many as still had swords, and then with their fists and their teeth, until the foreigners overwhelmed them with missile weapons, some attacking them in front and some throwing down the wall of defense and others standing around them in a ring. And finally, he tells us about one Spartan in particular, a guy named Eurystheus. Now, Eurystheus was excused from the battle and sent home because he had a severe eye infection. But we're told that when he heard that the Persians had cut the Greeks off, he had his helot, his serf, get his arms and lead him to the fighting. The helot then ran away, but Eurystheus plunged into battle, and even though he couldn't really see what he was doing, he fought and he died fighting. So those are my three anecdotes, and my question is, do you think they're true? Are they made up after the fact? Does it matter if they're true or not? And what can we learn from these stories?
Yeah, are they true? I'm sure there's some truth in them. I'm sure things like that happened. But whether it's, fact, and whether it matters, I don't think it matters, because what it does, it tells the ideal. It tells about the ideal of the Spartans, which is, again, the sense of honor. You fight to the end. You hold your ground, right? That goes back to the phalanx. You hold your ground no matter what, because the guy next to you, his life depends on you holding the ground. And this sense of honor and fear of shame, right? Like, I mean, we don't really have this anymore in our modern American culture, but if a Spartan warrior went back, it was found out that he ran away because he was afraid and he didn't hold the ground. He was shamed, like and even by the women. The women would shame him. His mother would shame
Definitely.
Him. In some instances, there's accounts of the mothers even killing their sons who ran away in shame. So the women played a huge role in enforcing the sense of honor amongst Spartan warriors. So I think it says a lot about that ideal, of their ideal that you hold your ground, you do your part no matter what. And also that, you know, that story about King Leonidas and trying to get his body. I think it shows the idea of, like, you know, you leave no man behind, right? Because there's that love that you have for the guy that you fought with that was molded and grown and through in the dining clubs and the agoge. There's that filial love where you love that guy and you're not gonna let anything happen to him, even in death. You're gonna take care of, make sure he got his proper death rites, burial rites. I mean, you see that even today, particularly in the American military. Leave no man behind, no matter what. You get his body. And because there's that love and that respect and reverence for your fellow comrade.
Yeah, very powerful idea. Let me just ask you about this detail that the Spartans fought with their swords, and then when their swords were gone, they fought with their fists and their teeth. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, again, it's just this. It didn't matter the tool at your disposal. You still had to fight. You still had to hold your ground. Now, whether that's true, like they fought with their teeth, I'm sure that happened. I'm sure there was, like, they turned into like this, you know, UFC wrestling bout, right? No rules, right? No holds bar. And I'm sure that happened. And they were gonna go down in a blaze of glory because they had that ideal of honor. And I think it's hard. Again, I think it's hard for us moderns to understand that mentality because it's not inculcated in us anymore. Your honor was the most important thing for an ancient Greek. It was your whole sense of self. And so you would fight for that until the very end. Because once that was given up, not only did it, you lose yourself in a way, but it brought, like, it lost a sense of self for your family members. It would bring them shame. There was a lot at stake. We don't have that anymore. And I think it's hard but I think if you try to think about it, I think you can every now and then understand it. Like when you watch, I don't know, like when you watch The Godfather, right? And you see, like, sort of those revenge killings. And you're like, yeah, at the same time, you're like, that's not good. But at the same time, like, I get it. It's family. It's honor. It's reputation. Like, you don't let anyone mess with your people, right? No one messes with my family. You kind of get it. But at the same time, yeah, you're also like, well, maybe that's not the right thing to do. But I think there's a sense that we can understand it. But for the ancient Greeks, that was their whole sense of identity, whole sense of self. So yeah, if they had to go to fist and teeth, that's what they'd have to do to defend that sense of self.
We still see it today in schoolyards.
Yeah, you do. Right. I mean, you see the whole idea of reputation. We call honor reputation today. Like, you gotta fight for your reputation. And definitely there's some downsides to that. There's some bad things that can come from that. But I think there's some good things that could come from that as well. Like, you having a sense of shame can be very healthy, right? Because it's a way to enforce cultural or social norms that are pro-social, right? So if you somehow don't fail to meet up to them, you feel a sense of shame. And then the whole point of shame is to direct yourself, to inspire you to, like, well, I don't want to feel like this anymore. What can I do to be better? I think that's when shame can be healthy, right? But yeah, it can definitely be taken in a negative way, for sure.
Sure. And we still use the term. Someone can say, I'm an honorable person.
We do. But I think when we say honorable, like, what we honor today is very private, right?
Yes.
It's like, I live by my own code. Right. As long as I'm living by my own code, if I'm authentic, then you can say, oh, well, that's honor. But honor for most of human history was a social thing. Your honor was decided by others in a way. Like you only had honor if others saw that you had honor, right? In the modern world, we've sort of internalized honor. And it's more of a private affair. So if you can like see, you know, look yourself in the mirror because you've lived by your code that you have, then that's honor today. But if you told that to an ancient Spartan, they'd be like, what are you talking about? That isn't honor. Your honor is what other people think of you, whether they think you're holding the line, whether they think you are living up to the ideals of a Spartan. That would be honor for them. So we have hints of it today. I think you can see it still in the military. There's this idea of honor that's still like that sort of ancient primordial honor. Firefighters, like police departments, gangs, wherever there's a group, a very strong cohesive group, you're going to probably find elements of that sort of primordial ancient sense of honor, where your sense of honor depended on how others saw you living up to the code, the shared code of the group.
I think that's true. We could talk about it some more. It's a fascinating subject, but I got to get back to Thermopylae. So another point you make is the importance of speaking laconically, briefly, pithily, to the point, and also with a sense of humor. And one of the most famous examples of this comes from Thermopylae, most famous Spartan examples. Supposedly before the battle, there was a Spartan named Deinakes, and he heard from another Greek that there were so many Persians that when they shot with their bows, the sun was hidden by the arrows. And he supposedly replied, no problem, this is good news, because if the Persians hide the sun, we'll fight them in the shade and not the sunshine. So that's cool, but why is it important for men today to speak laconically?
Is it important for men to speak in laconically? Well, I think what it does, but I think what you can learn from that is that whole idea, brevity is the soul of wit. Sometimes saying just enough is all you need to say. Talking on and on, if you don't have anything important to say, doesn't really do anything. But I also think the element of humor in laconic wit, humor is a way to deal, for the Spartans at least, was one of the ways they dealt with, it was sort of gallows humor. It prepared them psychologically to deal with the brutal stuff that they had to face. Death, carnage, loss of life of their fellow comrades. And so, you know, one way you deal with that is you kind of poke fun at it. And I think, you know, we do that to an extent too. Whenever you're going through a hard time, you make sometimes jokes that some people will be like, geez, why are you making that joke about this like serious thing? Well, it's a way for you to ease the psychological tension, which allows you in a counterintuitive way to deal with the problem more adeptly. Going on in the laconic wit, I think an important element of that was sort of that trading of barbs, right? That happened in the Sisatia, in the dining clubs, like where you would sort of tease, and it was a way to build camaraderie. I talked about that a bit. And it's funny, you see this in other warrior cultures, like the Vikings had flighting. So it's the same sort of thing where you would boast, and then you would try to like one up the guy next to you, sort of these battles, these duels of words. And the guy who would win was the funniest guy, the one who could do the zinger in the fewest amount of words. So you had that in the Vikings. The Comanche Indians had something similar as well. Another warrior culture. So I think it was a way to practice, sort of keep that battle ready mindset. Is a way to practice that, sort of fine tune it with words, right? And why is that important? I mean, what can men do that from that today? I don't know. I think we still respect individuals with wit, right? Who can say something insightful and funny, but also that's something that it speaks to a larger truth in the fewest amount of, like, you respect that. There's an improvisation that's involved that's admirable. It shows that you're thinking on your feet, that your mind is always is ready for any situation. So, I mean, I think it's good practice. It can help spur creativity. It can help spur different ways of looking at things. It can help if you had the gallows humor, if you have a humor about hard times, it can make those hard times a little bit less burdensome and allows you to deal with the problem more adeptly. So I think there's something you can learn from the Spartans in that way.
That's really great. And maybe it means there is some value to Twitter.
There could be. Yeah, there could be some value. I never thought about that. But yeah, maybe Twitter is just a ginormous dining club, Spartan dining club.
Maybe. Okay, thanks. Let's shift perspective slightly and ask what lessons Sparta might have for today's art of femininity, or at least for women, or maybe for male-female relations. You talked a little bit about Spartan women before and kind of as enforcers of codes for men. And in your book, you quote the famous Spartan saying, "With it or on it." What's that all about? And what does it tell us about Spartan women?
So again, to understand the role of Spartan women in Spartan culture, you have to remember, everything's geared towards warfare. And so for the Spartan women, their role, their primary role, was to give birth to future warriors. Now, this might sound like, okay, this is dystopian, right? It's like Handmaid's Tale. But what's interesting about this is, about the Spartans, is that the Spartan women actually had a lot more freedom and respect than other women in other city-states in ancient Greece. So to start with, Spartan girls were given an education. Many of them learned how to read and write. At age 7, they also took part in gymnastics, learned how to ride horses. And the reason why they did that was, well, because that would make them healthy when they became women, so they can give birth to healthy baby boys, ideally. Women in Sparta married later than other women in other city-states. So in Athens, for example, many women married at age 14. In Sparta, they married after age 18. So around in their 20s, they married. And the idea was the Spartans noticed that women who gave birth later were healthier than women who gave birth than teenagers. That's one idea, at least. Spartan women owned their own wealth. So if they inherited wealth from their father and they got married, well, that wealth stayed theirs. Men didn't have, their husbands didn't have control over it. So if they got divorced, they're able to keep their wealth. Women in Sparta were able to go out in public and walk around in public, while women in Athens, they had to stay in their house all the time. Also, women had they controlled the households, basically, because the men were always out either preparing for war or fighting. And so they were in charge of the households. And remember, for Spartans, a household was like a farm. They basically held an estate. So women made decisions about the farming business. They managed all the wealth in the household. And they had a lot of control. And in fact, I mean, the chauvinist here, Aristotle, the Athenian, he criticized the Spartans for the amount of control women had.
Right.
And he said that it was because the women had so much control that led to their downfall. Yeah, I mean, I think at one point in Spartan history, I think like 30% of all land was owned by women. So yeah, women had a great deal of autonomy. And so yeah, there's this idea in ancient Greece that Spartan women controlled the men. And sort of there's all these legends about, you know, pithy sayings of Spartan women. And there was one, I think it was Queen Gorgo.
Queen Gorgo?
Mm-hmm. Someone asked her, like, how is it that women in Sparta rule the men? And she responded, supposedly, "Well, we're the only ones who can give birth to men," right? Like, so she's like, you know, the Spartan women, we actually give birth to men. You other Greeks, you guys don't actually produce men. You produce little boys. So there's that. And, you know, that there's this idea also that, you know, I talked about women enforcing sort of bravery amongst the men. So there's stories of, you know, women saying to their boys or to their husbands, you know, "Come back carrying your shield or on it. That's the only way you can come back, either dead or alive." So there's that. And then there's all these other pithy sayings. There's other ideas. I mean, I talked about other ways the Spartan women enforced Greek male honor. Yeah, I mean, the women would shame their sons if they came back like a coward, sometimes killing them, maybe. So yeah, women played an important role in Sparta. It was definitely much more, they had a lot more freedom than their Athenian sisters.
It's very interesting. And, you know, I'll note that Rome, which was even a more successful military state than Sparta, in Rome, women had a lot of power, and the Roman mother was considered absolutely essential to having a successful son. So Italian mothers were important even in antiquity.
No, I think that's interesting.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. To shift again, let's consider at least briefly the case for the prosecution, if you will. What about what some people would call the bad side of Sparta? Things such as helotage, pederasty, philistinism, xenophobia, and hostility to democracy. And how would you respond to the charge that Sparta was guilty of, quote-unquote, toxic masculinity?
Yeah. So whenever you write a little small ebook praising the Spartans, you always get like, what about the Spartans? They did some really terrible things. And it's true. Like, you can't deny that. So as far as the role of helots, I mean, someone say that the whole reason that Sparta created their culture, warrior culture, was to keep the helots in check, right? I think the helots outnumbered the Spartans significantly. I think it's like 7-1. So they're just ready for war so they could keep those guys down. But then I think another thing...
Helots are basically the serfs.
They're serfs. Yeah, they're not slaves. I think that's something people need to understand. They're not. They weren't. They actually had more freedom than like an Athenian slave. You know, they had a plot of land. They were sure they were assigned by the state to a Spartan family. They had to grow and they had to give a certain amount to the Spartan state. But they got to keep the rest. So some helots were able to actually live a comfortable life. With that said, it was terrible to be a helot because, you know, once a year they declared war. The Spartans declared war on the helots. And, you know, just like open hunting season, basically. So yeah, it's terrible. I don't want to sugarcoat that. As far as being the Philistine thing, I mean, actually, I think it's a big myth about the Spartans. They were lovers of philosophy, lovers of music, lovers of... They didn't do a lot of art, right? Like pottery, things like that, like maybe the Athenians. But they liked a good song. They liked poetry. In fact, Plato, you know, sort of praises the Spartans for their love of philosophy. I think that's a myth that's sort of gotten out there. If you look at the record, they were actually pretty intelligent, pretty smart. But yeah, their whole philosophy, their academic life was geared towards warfare. I mean, this will make us better warriors, right? So we'll study philosophy. The xenophobia, yeah, I mean, like that happened in ancient Greece. That was they were very insular. Right. They kept to themselves. If you weren't a Spartan, then you were less than. And yeah, they had that. I can't sugarcoat that as much. Podiatry. Yeah, that happened as well. And that's something I wouldn't want to bring back. I wouldn't encourage men revive that at all. But I think when you study, I mean, you study the classics and I think you can find these big picture insights where they got like the big picture right. And then I think we can learn something from it and maybe find a way to apply it in our modern life. And so for me, I mean, I think the big thing that I got from the Spartans was this idea of civic virtue, right? Like belonging to a community where you held up certain ideals. But again, they were, like I said, they were totalitarian. Like at the same time, like I admire that, but at the same time, like, I don't know if I'd actually want to be a part of that. Right. I think there's a balance that you can find of belonging to a community, but also respecting the rights of an individual. And I think in America today, we're more, you know, we lean more towards the individual side. And I think there's a longing, a desire for more community, but community is hard there. I think when we think of community, you always think of like the fun stuff. Oh, you know, people getting together and doing, you know, dancing, singing, doing community art projects, but like community is hard because you have to deal with like annoying neighbors, right? You have to have tough conversations. It's exhausting, right? But I think that battle, right? That idea that, okay, there's something I can belong to that's bigger than me is worth it because it gives you a sense of significance. It gives you a sense of meaning. But I also think it's possible to have that while also balancing your sense of individuality. Now, is this easy? No. It's incredibly, incredibly hard. It's a tension you have to walk. But I think you find significance and meaning within that tension. I think the Spartans can teach us about how to maybe recapture that sense of community. So like maybe you're a guy, you're looking for some friends. Maybe you start like a men's group, right? Modeled after the gentleman's club. You have a gentleman's dinner once a month. And that could be something you just get together, you grill some steaks, grill some burgers, and you talk once a month. That's it. And you can get that's something from the Spartans. Now, I think there's something you can learn from that. As far as the idea of toxic masculinity, well, they were a warrior culture. Everything was geared towards whether it would make them a good soldier. And so today we would call that probably toxic masculinity, right? Shaming and just rejecting men who didn't meet the standard. There's nothing you can really say to that, right? Like but you have to understand, like that was their culture. That's what allowed them to survive. So again, what I'm saying, like, do we want to imitate completely everything the Spartans did? No. But I think there's some lessons we can take that where you can apply the big picture into our own lives.
Well, thank you. You know, great ideas. And I think you've implicitly answered my last question, which is whether the ideal of Thermopylae is still alive today and whether we'd be capable of making a last stand for our country or our beliefs. I think from what you're saying, it depends in part on our sense of community and our sense of honor. And maybe we have that in the military. I hope we do. But perhaps we could use more of it elsewhere in our society.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think today everyone has this feeling that everything's super divided in America in particular. But I'm an optimist. I'm also a romantic. I'm an optimist. But I'm also going to be cynical and jaded. But I sometimes like to ignore a lot what you see was going on the internet. The internet, I think, can sort of distort how things really are. If you look at real life, how people are actually interacting with one another, just on a day-to-day basis, I think there's signs of positivity that there is a sense of community. People are, for the most part, decent. And you see these, you know, signs within cities of people doing things together and coming together as a community. In America, could there ever be something like a Sparta? I don't think so. America's too big and too diverse for that. I think that to ever happen. But I think you can have smaller, it's like you can scale down a bit on it, and you can get it maybe like on a city level. You could see it happen at a neighborhood level. You could see something similar to Sparta, right, where there's community events going on and people are sort of looking out for each other. Other countries possibly, I think, you know, an Israel might be able to like have that sort of sense. They kind of have a very Spartan like way of life. I think there's mandatory military service, right, for all citizens. And that mandatory military service builds a lot of social cohesion. I think some other countries that have that sort of thing could have that sort of Spartan like on a nation level. And I mean, that kind of raises an interesting question. I mean, there's in America, at least, some really controversial, provocative ideas is to build up that cohesion is bringing back the military draft is one I've heard, you know, people say, well, that'll help build up more sort of social cohesion, right? If everyone's susceptible to being drafted and fighting for the country, well, then, you know, everyone's got some skin in the game. And then everyone kind of comes together and has to fight together and work together. And that can have some benefits socially. The other one was national service, mandatory national service, right? So, you know, after you graduate high school, you're required to spend 2 years doing some sort of service. Those are controversial ideas because it sort of goes in the face of our very individualist, you know, rugged individualist idea. Like, you're not going to make me do this thing. I'm an American. But those are ideas that, you know, you could sort of bring cohesion. But again, I think you can scale that down. You don't have to make it a national thing. You could, you know, it doesn't have to be mandatory, but you create a culture where it's just expected, right? You do some sort of service in your community. So yeah, is it possible? I don't think we'll ever have like a Spartan culture like they did, but I think you can scale it down a bit and get something similar to that.
Well, thank you. It's been a really intriguing conversation, and I know that we'll want to continue talking about the suggestions you've made at the end, national service, revived draft, maybe a smaller scale way to bring back certain Spartan ideals with a full understanding that there are many things about Sparta that we wouldn't want to bring back.
Exactly,
today.
Yeah.
So thank you again for putting the Battle of Thermopylae in perspective and giving us some idea of why and how the Spartans were able to fight the way they did and why it matters today. So I'd just like to remind listeners about the Art of Manliness, artofmanliness.com, and also about Brett McKay's terrific, pithy, laconic book, The Spartan Way. If you want a brief entree into Sparta and what it's all about, it's just a terrific way to start. So thank you very much again, Brett. It's been really great.
Thank you, Barry. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you. And please like us on iTunes. And if you are so moved, write a review. See you all again soon on Antiquitas.
Theme music by Lush Life.